Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. If you're just joining us, Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, and the moderator of this discussion, is leading a panel on a conversation about campus safety. Downs will pose his next question to Tom Rhodes, corporate director of public safety for Parkview Health. Enjoy.
Tom, you mentioned that on an annual basis, there are at least one, I'm sure there's more than one thing that you do, but when it comes right down to it, what are the first steps that should be taken when thinking about safety at a campus in terms of day-to-day? What should an organization do first?
Certainly, I think identifying your potential risks is number one. Mm-hmm. And then, as Jim and Julie know, with any security process, the first thing you need to consider is how do you control your perimeter? If needed. So, and we do that through various means, through technology, cameras, as well as access control points that we can lock or unlock at any given time. But identifying those risks, controlling your perimeter, and then understanding the staffing levels that are going to be needed to provide as secure an environment as possible. One thing I think is important to realize is that it's impossible to be 100% secure. So you want to take whatever prudent steps you can and be reasonable in your approach to mitigate the risk to a reasonable level. I used to say policing in a democracy is the toughest job in the world. If we were in a dictatorship, you could police and make a much more secure environment. But people have freedoms, and we have an open campus at Parkview, so we have to accept that and understand, you know, what are the reasonable steps we can take. And by really putting in place a hospital police department, I thought was a reasonable step, as opposed to putting metal detectors at all of our entrances, which would really be a cumbersome feat to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think, I'm trying to remember, I know Jim was on the police force when Sarah Palin came to town in 2008, and at the Coliseum, they had metal detectors and people were walking through them, but that really slowed down people getting into the facility for the event, and eventually they just stopped paying attention to what was happening with the metal detectors, just finally said, come on in, walk on in if you want to, which for some people seemed like a violation of that safety step that was taken there. Jim, you actually help people set up safety plans for their organizations.
I do.
What are the first steps? If somebody came to you and said, I want to talk to you about this, what's the initial meeting like?
I have them set up a security control plan. First, you got to start with a plan. Mm-hmm. In that plan, you have to have a policy statement to talk about, you know, what you expect and what your rules and your regulations are going to be. You need to do evaluations of your work areas, your engineering controls and your work practice controls, make sure that those are all in line. And then you finally end up with training. And then the last part of all of this is that you have to institute it and continue that training.
In terms of risk factors, what would an organization be looking for? For example, Tom, if a new building were opening up in the Parkview system, what do you count as a risk factor?
Well, we actually have actually assigned a manager to that very task of being on all the new construction projects. We're always building something new at Parkview.
There you are.
And the first thing again is understanding the purposes of that business. You know, are we going to be servicing folks who are in mental health crisis, or is it going to be a walk-in clinic? You know, what are the specifics that we'll be doing in that building? And then really understanding again the access points and the perimeter first and foremost for our control measures, and then educating staff on. What, as Jim mentioned, what are the proper procedures if we do end up with an incident that results in some kind of violent act?
Mm-hmm. Julie, when you came here to IPFW, what were your first steps?
Yeah, I have some things to add. we had a large safety committee, and a lot of it wasn't quite as effective as it could have been because there were almost too many people on that committee. So creating a subcommittee of half a dozen people who were vested in that interest was really important. And then one thing that I think was really crucial was getting people involved in their small workspace. And I say small, it could be the floor of Kettler Hall, but actually involving the people who were there on a daily basis to help report out things, dangers, hazards. Sometimes there are things that are happening on campus construction-wise that I don't know about or the police department doesn't know about, and having people to kind of see those things and report them out is so important, but also to keep them involved on a quarterly basis at least with communication and asking them to help spread the word and things that we need to have put out there.
Mm-hmm. Since I was on the committee with you, we met, some would say frequently, maybe too frequently. But really, how often should an organization be looking at safety procedures and precautions within their organization? Like you said, we meet quarterly.
I think it depends on the level, too, of what it is that you're trying to do. If it's something where you're trying to prepare for an upcoming drill, then meeting on a more regular basis monthly to be prepared so that it's a successful practice, I think that's important. So it depends on what your mission is. Mm-hmm.
Jim, how do you get that organization that's just starting out from scratch? They've done nothing. You've come in, you've gotten them to put together their initial plan. What's a good practice for them to get into?
Well, usually I begin doing a site assessment, and there's a questionnaire that I will utilize to find out, you know, where their weaknesses are, where their strengths are, and we'll sit down and try to determine a plan of action as to how to do that, you know, help them with their policies and so on. Mm-hmm.
And then after they've gotten through that, how often should they be looking at things?
I would say any time that a task or an employee has been changed. I know in the healthcare, there's some of the nursing facilities that I've mm-hmm. done assessments on that their turnaround is rather high. So that may not be practical to do at any time that an employee has been hired or fired. But at least annually, you need to look at those policies and procedures to make sure that you're doing what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Andy, I would add that really the process needs to happen every day. When folks are coming to work, it might not be a formal safety meeting. Our safety meetings are every month, but we do have safety huddles, kind of to your point, mm-hmm. Julie, of in the workplace, the nurse leaders coming together, and our security and public safety team is involved in that, understanding, you know, the patients who we have on the floor. Is there someone who's again suffering from a gunshot wound in the community? What risk factors are there? Are there family issues with a patient? So just touching base first thing at each shift and understanding where those concerns may lie can certainly make a response much, much quicker and much more appropriate if something does happen.
And that has to be integrated with the caregivers, actually. I mean, there are folks like you, but if you're not talking with the caregivers, so the caregivers really have to be part of this on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you get them to buy into that?
You know, it really wasn't difficult. Our staff, our medical and clinical staff have really become really reliant on our public safety team in a lot of ways. And we really integrated ourselves in the compassionate care component of Parkview Health, even though we wear a different uniform. Mm-hmm. We're all there for the same thing, the compassionate care, making sure that patients receive an excellent care, but also ensuring that through training, education, and conversations with our nursing staff that we're creating a safe and secure environment of care so they can really focus on delivering that excellent care to the patient.
Julie, coming back to IPFW, when you're trying to get people to sort of buy in and commit to showing up on a regular basis to a meeting that they believe is productive, mm-hmm. how do you get them to do that?
Well, I think you keep it small, first of all, and you only ask the people who have that vested interest. As far as the building coordinators, they can be less involved in that process, but it's really identifying the people who feel strongly about safety on the campus and making, pushing those safety features forward.
Mm-hmm. How do you spread it out further then? I mean, you get that core, they're willing to do it, but how do you spread it out?
I will tell you what I did. I walked from building to building to building, and sometimes it's as easy as walking into the math department and saying, do you have someone who will take care of ETCS second floor? And they say sure, or and sometimes it's a little bit more difficult than that, but with persistence, and I think with that face-to-face meeting and explaining how important it is, that really gives people, that they feel an ownership in wanting to be a part of that safety.
Mm-hmm. Jim, obviously if people have called you up, they've made some sort of a commitment, at least, you know, in terms of thinking about it for a moment, but do you get the feeling occasionally that the commitment's not there, and if so, how do you get them to really embrace it?
I think the commitment for the most part is there if they're reaching out to me. They didn't necessarily have an act that it had occurred, mm-hmm. but they realized the potential of it occurring. I really don't see there being a much of an issue. Once they contact me, then I sit down with their employees. I do an hour-long block regarding workplace violence, and I've had a pretty good response and pretty good turnout.
And when they're there, how much of it is you explaining to them how to integrate this into their daily activity, and how much of that is sort of left up to them to figure out as just part of their daily activity?
Initially, it's me explaining to them what their options are, how they can be safe, how they can get out of an area, how they can evacuate. In some cases, you know, they may have to fight it as a last resort.
Mm-hmm. Tom? I was going to add some of the companies I've kind of done some work with as well. I think they're buying into the safety concept. One reason is because OSHA is pushing it more. under the general duty clause to provide a safe environment for your coworkers, that is starting to be really stretched into the workplace violence field. And we're seeing companies who are fined by OSHA for not doing certain trainings, educations, or taking steps to provide a safe environment for their coworkers.
I heard someone actually in law enforcement not too long ago say that you can do as much drilling as you want, but you're never really prepared. Do you agree with this theory, Tom?
I saw that question early on. I don't know that I completely agree with that. Certainly the more you train, the more you drill, the better prepared you are. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we're ever there. It's a continuous process, but I know for a fact that training does result in better outcomes. And Joplin, Missouri is an example of that. Certainly our training on the police department is a constant daily reminder that training does matter. And I think some folks get really confused on education and training. When we do presentations and PowerPoint educational opportunities, those are education. We educate the mind. But training is really going out and practicing what you've learned and going through the actions of what you would do if you have an active shooter or another critical. You know, we can talk about evacuating the hospital, but until our staff use the maxi slides and the other devices we have to evacuate patients, they're not going to have a good understanding of what it really takes to evacuate.
Tabletop drills, are you a fan of those?
I'm a fan. It's a part, but you can't stop at the tabletop. Mm-hmm. You need to take it to the next level. And one thing you have to do and we do a lot of emergency preparedness drills in healthcare. One thing you have to do is you have to push the drill past your resources so that you really are stretched to uncover other opportunities for improvement.
And that really is kind of the purpose of the drill, isn't it, Jim? I mean, you do the drill so that you find out what you did well, but more importantly, what you didn't do well.
What you didn't do well, exactly. Mm-hmm. The stress that you're going to be under when you're in an actual incident is a lot different than the training exercises. But what we try to do is to understand ways that you can lower that stress level when you're involved in those types of situations. People don't know how to respond unless they've been in that situation before. Mm-hmm. The one term that I really dislike is, you know, they're going to rise to the threat. Well, they're not going to rise to the threat. Studies have shown that under stressful situations that you're going to default to your level of training. You're not mm-hmm. going to rise to the threat.
Mm-hmm. Julie?
People are concerned about their own safety, and they're concerned about people around them. So I think that what Jim mentioned earlier about being always looking for the opportunity to do what needs to be done in that moment is really what is key. So it can be anywhere from a classroom on a Thursday evening in a criminal investigations class to you know, anything, as long as you're aware of your surroundings and constantly thinking about your personal safety.
How do you do the assessment afterwards? And let's Tom, you pointed out education is one part. Tabletop mm-hmm. gets you a little closer to an actual event, and mm-hmm. then there's the actual drill itself. How do you assess along the way? I mean, education, it's easy. We test you afterwards. Did you know, right. don't put these two chemicals together or not? That was an easy one. Tabletop becomes a little more difficult, and the drill itself is even more difficult. How do you assess?
Well, we certainly set objectives before the drill. And you can't set a large number of objectives. We really trained our safety team to focus on one or two parts for this drill. We can re-drill again later, and we'll look at other objectives. But keeping the objectives small to begin with in your drill, and then having spot people or people who stand by and watch and observe the drill. And you know, again, you can talk through a tabletop all you want, but you don't know until you try it whether this device is going to go through this door or whatever. And you start running into obstacles that you didn't identify early on. And again, most time the failures begin with communication, and so I think that's always something we uncover. Mm-hmm. Seems like every drill, mm-hmm. but I think you have to have third-party people evaluating the drill as it's going on.
Jim, you've actually you do this for folks.
I think the biggest part, it's at the end of everything, is a debrief. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to have a good debriefing, you know, let people know what they did right, and try to fix the problem if there was an issue. So, mm-hmm. and I know on call-outs, barricades, and hostage situations, things like that, we have a debrief with the CRT team and the emergency services team at the end of each incident.
And that's one thing, to have the people who are involved ready, but what happens when you identify something like missing locks on buildings and those sorts of things? Julie, how do you deal with that?
That was our first full-scale drill here at IPFW. When I got here was that fire drill, and that was a full-scale evacuation of buildings across campus. We identified some lacks in student housing. That's an important place where fire systems need to be working. We also identified some of the upgrades that we could make and modifications we could make. So I think the drills are so important in just identifying, having the pre-plan, like Tom mentioned, doing the after-action report and sharing it, not only with the committee, the safety committee, but also with those building coordinators that you rely on to kind of be your eyes and ears out on campus is really crucial.
This is an ongoing process, especially, you know, if you think about the event, there's a big event, a drill, and people sort of, okay, we learned something from it, and then mm-hmm. they can almost forget it. But if you keep drilling, it'll get into their head, they'll rise to the level of their training more accurately. Mm-hmm. But something like a modification to a building, that is so easy to forget. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to take that on as almost their cause, don't they?
They do.
One of the things I tell people is to make sure that you have your escape routes and your emergency plans posted in conspicuous places throughout the building. In stressful situations, people forget where they're at sometimes. The mm-hmm. other advantage to that is when we show up, sometimes if it's a third right. floor classroom and we're yeah. not familiar with it, we'll take it off the wall, and that way we can formulate our plan to find out, you know, how we can get up there and stop the incident.
Yeah, Tom, how much time do you spend talking with the folks who handle building construction and maintenance? You said you have folks right. who are there when new construction's going on.
Sure, they're involved in our safety committee and our emergency preparedness committee. So it's a, you know, we are, healthcare is heavily regulated. And much of that regulation, the part that we deal with is life safety and environment of care. You know, we're talking about a fire drill. You know, we do one drill per shift per quarter for every department in the hospital. So we're doing fire drills every day. We're regulated on how many mass casualty drills we conduct and how many tornado drills we conduct. And so we are almost in a constant state of drilling in the hospital environment, which is obviously a good thing. Checking, you know, our public safety officers are even involved in the environment of care surveys as they're rounding. Are our egress routes open? Are the doors securing properly? Do they open during a fire drill? I mean, everything you can imagine is happening really on a daily basis in the hospital environment.
Is there, you know, we hear often about how Parkview has scored and other hospitals score in certain rankings. Is there an accreditation or something for healthcare facilities?
There is. The Joint Commission is who conducts most of the surveys for healthcare. They are hired by CMS, which is the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So if you want your funding from the federal government, you will certainly meet Joint Commission survey standards.
And there are safety standards in that as well.
Yeah, I really can't even begin to explain that survey process. You just have to experience
right.
it. But for a hospital like Parkview Regional and Parkview Randalia, which is on the same license, we may have 8 to 10 surveyors for 5 days.
Wow.
And there are some that are medical that will do tracers, tracing of patients, access through the hospital. There are life safety ones that will be going around with us and making sure that, you know, if we have a drill, that we've done a hot wash afterwards, and if we identified an opportunity for improvement, there better be follow-up, whether it's work orders or completed processes showing that that was taken care of. There really is there's no grace period for not having these things taken care of.
I think a lot of people have heard of the Joint Commission or JCO, mm-hmm. but I don't know that people realize there was a safety component to that as well.
Yeah, so absolutely.
It is quite thorough.
Yep. Yeah. And then once they leave, OSHA may come in.
Sure.
And when they leave, the State Department of Health comes in. So, I mean, we talk a lot about being in a constant state of survey readiness.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to just meet the minimum standards. We want to make sure we're exceeding those standards as well.
We'll have more from WBOI Presents in just a short moment. Stay tuned.